Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is your host, Travis Hornsby. The baby's sleeping right now, and I have no idea how long he's going to sleep. So we're going to dive into the new repay plan and what it means and why this is just an earth-shattering moment in higher education. We had a talk about new repay last week. I wanted to just give you my thoughts and just explain a little bit about what I think is going on with just all of this stuff that's happening. First, what is Biden doing? So he's basically saying that the existing repayment plans, there's too many of them and he wants fewer. So instead of creating a brand new repayment plan, he said, well, wait a second. This repay plan is available to anybody with direct loans. And all I've got to do is modify the terms of an existing plan instead of creating a new one. So what he's keeping the same is 20 years till forgiveness for undergrad and 25 years till forgiveness for grad school. And probably, you know, Parent Plus will still be able to access this through the Parent Plus double consolidation loophole for probably 25 years. That part's not changing. What is changing is being able to file separately for taxes on repay, which is a big deal. That's going to eliminate old IBR filing separate in almost every case. And he's doing interest subsidies of 100% of unpaid interest instead of 50% like the existing repay plan. Under the existing repay plan, let's say your payment's $500 a month and you have $1,500 a month of interest total that would be accumulating. Usually $1,000 would be left over, and the existing repay plan covers 50% of that, so $500. This new repay plan will cover all of that leftover interest. Now note that if your payment is, you know, your required payment under repay is going to fully cover your interest, there is no interest subsidy. It's not the same thing as zero interest like the current student loan pause is. That's different. So that's what he's trying to do. In addition, he's giving 225% of the poverty line instead of 150%, so that's a big deal, especially for larger families. And when you look at the way all these things interact too, for undergrad loans only, they're doing 5% of income. And then for grad loans, it's 10%. And if you've got anywhere in between that, it's a weighted average. People with 50-50 undergrad grad loans would pay 7.5% of that discretionary income, which is your AGI minus 225% of the poverty line. Now, another thing they're doing is changing the definition of family size, basically. They're saying if you file separately, you can't include your spouse in the family size count. So if you have a family size of 4 and you file separate, instead of 4, your family size is 3. But both spouses could file separate and include the kids, so both spouses could have a family size of 3. And with this new 225% of the poverty line deduction, that's a massive deduction. That is huge. So if you kind of look at this just more, you know, you kind of pick a case example, you could say a family size of, let's say, 5. And so the poverty line for a family size of 5, if you're filing separately, it's family size of 4. So that poverty line is $30,000. So if you take 2.25 times 30,000, it's about 67,000. So if you file separately, then you both get that deduction, right? So a family could be earning up to almost $140,000 jointly if your income is split 50-50, right down the middle. So you can earn up to $140,000 if you're each making 70K and you have a large family and pay nothing up until you're making over 70,000. That's earth-shattering, and the interest is subsidized. So you might say, wow, this plan's so good, I should switch into it, right? Not so fast. There's a huge trap here. And the trap is 25 years instead of 20 years till forgiveness. So for those of you going for pay-as-you-earn, if you look at the math, the pay-as-you-earn plan for grad school people that have 10% of the income like they would for the new repay plan, the payment difference for a lot of people is not going to be that big, particularly if you have like an average-sized family, like one or two kids, for example. And that means if you're only going to save about $100 a month on a lower payment, you would much rather have 20 years until forgiveness instead of 25. Now, the problem with the way they designed this plan is that people are going to be blocked off from signing up for pay-as-you-earn after July 2023. That's earth-shattering. That's crazy. That blows my mind. In fact, let me just say a quick caveat about the way the Biden administration designed this income-driven repayment overhaul. It's a bad decision the way they're doing it. And the reason it's a bad decision is because you're saying that a president can block off people with pay-as-you-earn in their promissory notes that are in school from signing up for it after a certain date. The issue with that is, yes, current borrowers in pay-as-you-earn are not being touched. You're not going to get kicked out of pay-as-you-earn. You can stay in it. But if you haven't signed up for it yet, there's a whole bunch of people that are maybe in their third year of dental school that have pay-as-you-earn in their promissory notes, and those people are not going to be allowed to sign up for pay-as-you-earn when they graduate. Is that a big deal? Well, it depends. If you have a very kind of exponential type of income, like a lot of higher income medical professionals do, then that's not good. You'd much rather have 20 years until forgiveness instead of 25. You know, if we think about the pay-as-you-earn plan itself, who does that really affect? Well, you have access to something called new IBR, new income-based repayment, if you're a new borrower for the first time as of July 2014. So this plan, we almost never bring it up in consults, and the reason is because it's the exact same thing as pay-as-you-earn is. New IBR is 10% of your income for 20 years, and you can file separate. That new IBR replaces old IBR if you're a new borrower as of July 2014. But pay-as-you-earn is the exact same thing, and pay-as-you-earn has a limit on interest capitalization. You know, there's really no reason why you would do new IBR instead of pay-as-you-earn if you're eligible for both, because pay-as-you-earn is the exact same thing, and it's very slightly better. But with this new IBR plan becoming a lot more important for borrowers that are just borrowed for the first time after 2014, the reason why it's more important is because they cannot stop you from signing up for new IBR. Why is that? To get a little technical for a second, the pay and the repay plans exist because they're created from the ICR statute. In this statute, basically, 1990s era Republicans in Congress gave a giant gift to future, more progressive presidential administrations. And the reason is because the Republicans in the 90s were really stupid as to how they wrote the bill in terms of if your goal is to not make these programs for student loans very generous. Because what the Republicans in Congress did is they said, you can create, you know, an ICR plan, income contingent repayment plan, that shall be no more than 20% of your income and no more than 25 years until forgiveness. So when you say no more than, that means it can be less than. That means if the Secretary of Education wanted to, they could create a plan that's 5% of your income for 10 years. That was the big loophole that the Obama administration and the Biden administration exploited very, very smartly by saying, well, we can create a new income-driven repayment plan however we want to under this ICR statute. So that's subject to executive order. The thing that's not subject to executive order is the income-based repayment plan. That's in a statute. You have to have 60 votes in the Senate to get rid of old IBR and new IBR. And furthermore, you cannot stop people from signing up for new IBR. That's illegal because it's in the statute. Now, what the Biden administration is trying to do is they're saying if you've been on repay for 10 years, then you cannot switch into IBR. Presumably, they're going to say that the new repay plan will not count towards new IBR if you switch into it after 10 years onto the repay plan. They're trying to avoid what we always thought that they would try to do at some point, which is to say a lot of people would always ask us, well, why can't I do 19 years on repay and get the interest subsidies and then switch into pay-as-you-earn at the very last moment to get 20-year forgiveness? They thought of that. So that's something that's in the regulations too to prevent that. So who needs to take action on this? Anybody who is a new borrower as of October 1st, 2007, between that and July 2014. And the reason is that's the group of people that is eligible for pay-as-you-earn that's not eligible for new IBR. If you're eligible for new IBR, there's no problem. We can just sign you up for new IBR if we decide that it's better to go for 20-year forgiveness, and we can do that at any point in the future. But people that are not on pay-as-you-earn right now need to figure out if you need to be on pay-as-you-earn. And why is that? Think about, again, they're blocking people from signing up for it after July 2023 when these regulations for IDR take effect. If we think about who would not switch onto it, so you know, maybe some of our consults, if you think about, you might have had a $20 a month payment for income-based repayment, or maybe you had a $200 a month payment for revised pay-as-you-earn, and you're now a higher income professional, or you're making more money, or because your income was much higher because they used a tax return when you graduated, when you certified last, and now you're making a lot more, you didn't want to lose that $200 a month payment. That's the problem here, because maybe your plan was to switch from repay or IBR to pay-as-you-earn, but to wait until they required you to recertify your income. Those are the folks that I'm concerned about, is you want that really low payment and you don't want to have to recertify your income. But at the same time, if you're not on pay-as-you-earn as of this new effective date of July 2023, you lose the option ever to go on to pay-as-you-earn in the future, and you're stuck on a plan that's 25 years instead of 20 years. And you know, if I was a borrower, I would want this out of my life as soon as possible. I would be willing to pay $100 or $200 a month more to make sure that my loans would end earlier, if at all possible. I will say that for folks that didn't have the situation that were told to get on repay or told to get on pay-as-you-earn that talked with us, that advice is still sound, because we put people on repay generally because they're not eligible for pay-as-you-earn and it's better than income-based repayment, or if you need that interest subsidy more than you need other things. So all of that is still true. There's, you know, if anything, the repay plan is just getting supercharged, just getting even better. That advice is sound. People that were told to get on pay-as-you-earn because they're very clear forgiveness cases, that advice is sound, because most likely the costs of saving those 5 years of payment on the end are worth being on pay-as-you-earn, paying slightly more than if you were on repay. Now, what else the Biden administration did that's concerning here is they're modifying an existing plan. The ICR statute says no more than 20% of income, no more than 25 years till forgiveness. the Biden administration is making certain borrowers on repay worse off. Who? Let's give an example. You've got somebody who's making $100,000 a year with $500,000 of student loans married to somebody making $100,000 a year with $50,000 of student loans. So this is a classic double debt loophole situation where under the old rules, you would file separately for taxes. The person with the $500,000 of loans would be on pay-as-you-earn and would probably be able to pay about $500 a month. And then the person that's got the $50,000 of student loans, because the repay plan required filing jointly, it always would look at your situation and apply a payment proportionally based on the size of your debt. So they would calculate that total payment, probably about $1,500 overall as a married couple, that would be completely not applied in the case of the person on pay-as-you-earn. And then the person who is got the $50,000 of loans would have 10%, since they have 10% of the debt, they would have 10% of $1,500 be their monthly payment. So they would pay $150 a month instead of, you know, $500 a month if they filed taxes separately. For some people, it's not super common, but for some people, their payment is literally going to double or more than double by these changes in the repay rules. That's why this is a very dangerous precedent. And the reason is, imagine a future Republican president who decides that he or she wants to amend the new repay plan that the Biden administration came out with to get rid of it because they think it's too generous, right? Well, now what's being created is a precedent to say that if not all borrowers are made better off under a change in income-driven repayment plans, that the president can simply modify that plan and do whatever they want with it. So a future Republican president might say, well, I can modify this plan and make it 20% of income for 25 years with no interest subsidies because some borrowers will pay less in interest by being forced to pay off their debts sooner. That could be an argument that's made by a future president, by the Biden administration, deciding for, yes, operational reasons, but possibly I would argue also PR reasons, not to create yet another repayment plan that is posing a big risk legally to the future of the more generous income-driven repayment plans that have been created by Democratic administrations under the ICR statute. Now, I will get into one more really big topic, and maybe two more in today's podcast. We're going to talk about the effect of this new plan on undergraduate borrowers. What does this do for undergraduate borrowers? It's pretty staggering. So I mentioned, you know, if you have two people making $70,000 of income, and they've got $140,000 joint income, and they've got three kids, that you're getting this deduction by filing separately of about $67,000 of taxable income. Now, let's say that you're working in some sort of like middle management type of position. You don't live to work, you work to live. You're not trying to make, you know, some sort of executive role. Or maybe you're just in a more modest income role in healthcare where you know you're not going to make six figures or something, but you got your degree as a bachelor's, let's say. And so if you think about this example, so let's say you've got undergrad-only debt. You each maybe have $30,000 of loans from undergrad. In prior years, there was no way you were getting PSLF because you couldn't get a low enough payment so that you'd have anything left over to forgive after 10 years. But this new change in the rules would allow you to file taxes separately, right? So let's say you're making, you know, $80,000 a year each, so $160,000 total, and each of you have $30,000 of undergrad debt, so $60,000 of undergrad debt total. That was not a forgivable case in the past. But what's happening with this new change in the rules is, you know, you get to exclude all that larger 225% of the poverty line deduction and then only have to pay for undergrad loans 5% of the amount above that. So let's say you're making, you know, $80,000. Well, you're going to pay 5% of the income above $67,000 if you've got three kids. So that means 5% of $13,000. Let's just real quick here pull up our little handy dandy calculator and we'll say $13,000 times 0.05. So that's $650 a year or about $54 a month. Now let's think about planning opportunities. Let's say you make $100,000 a year and you save the maximum for your 401k in 2023, which is $22,500. Now your AGI is $77,500 and you subtract that $67,000, you've got $10,000 left over and then you take 5% of that to figure out what your payment is. And that's about $40 a month. When we look at the math now, for really middle and upper middle income families with undergraduate loans, what these new repay rules have done is taken, you know, even higher income families, not high income families, obviously, but higher income families that are, you know, at least top third of the income distribution, right? Or top 40% of the income distribution, that's taking that kind of a household and making them a forgiveness case. One of the things that we're going to have to think through with our business model is how do we serve this new group of people that suddenly needs our advice, because it's going to be a lot of people out there. Basically, anybody that was a, You know, think back in the day, like when I first started this, one of the bigger brands that was much bigger than us that competed with us was Student Loan Hero. And Student Loan Hero would get the typical every man, every woman, $35,000 student loan refinance. That site would rank in the top of Google search for student loan refinancing. People would all just go to Student Loan Hero and refinance the $35,000 from a 5.5% to a 4.5% because there was no way that that person was going to get any forgiveness. Well, now that person is a fantastic candidate to get forgiveness if you know the rules. And that's the huge caveat, if you know the rules. Now, there's other things, other nuances that are going to impact this new repay situation. The pay and the new IBR plans have a cap on payments. So you can pay up to that standard 10-year cap and it won't ever go above that. So if you're going for PSLF, there's a situation where if you were on new repay, you could pay way more than you need to because you could be on pay and have your payment capped out. So that would make somebody with $300,000 of income and $100,000 of medical school debt on pay as you earn a great candidate for getting PSLF forgiveness, whereas on new repay, they might not benefit from that capped payment, and so they would pay the whole thing off. There are also a bunch of new rules about deferment and forbearance. So if basically the general rule is if the deferment or forbearance was not your fault, then you're going to get credit for it towards forgiveness for PSLF and non-PSLF forgiveness situations. So if you have economic hardship deferment, if you have cancer treatment deferment, if you have a mandatory administrative forbearance that's imposed on you, then you're going to get credit for forgiveness for those types of things too now. Now, if you have a voluntary or discretionary forbearance that you ask for, that doesn't count, but you also have the ability to look back and kind of catch up yourself with those, with basically making payments of what you would have had to pay to get credit for that period in the past. All these super generous rules, right? And it looks great on paper, and it will be tremendous if it's implemented for borrowers. It'll save you a lot of money. And I think it probably will be implemented. That's another thing I'll say is, unlike cancellation, where it's something that I do not think the Supreme Court is going to allow, I think that we're really, you know, in a situation where I think that we're going to see that shut down. And then I think we're going to see this IDR plan probably upheld. Now, one of the things we have to wait for is the 30-day comment period. We have to wait and see if people put in their 30-day comments to see if, you know, what the comments are. Department of Ed has to respond to it. Usually that's a formality. When the final rule is published, that would be the first time somebody could sue over it. Now, unlike cancellation, where you have like servicers losing revenue from losing people they're servicing accounts for, this particular new repay plan doesn't necessarily have any obvious losers except for people that are, well, I guess I could say taxpayers, but obviously student loan borrowers are taxpayers too. I would say it doesn't have any losers except for people opposed to the policy, I guess you could say. So people opposed to the policy, who would that be? House GOP. So if the House GOP sues, they might have a chance at stopping this. And I'm not giving them any original ideas. Don't worry. They're already very much talking about this based off of the sources that I know of. And so will they sue over this and say, well, yes, the Secretary of Education can come up with a repayment plan, but this is not a repayment plan? They can make that argument. Will they? I don't know. I don't think it's particularly attractive or, you know, sexy politically to go after this IDR plan because it's so wonky and people don't really understand what it is. Department of Ed is really smart, and how they're portraying this is not that big of a cost. They basically said it was only going to cost $137 billion. I think that's way off. I think it's going to cost at least $1 trillion over 10 years. Department of Ed said the interest subsidy would only cost $14 billion. I don't know what they're smoking over there to come up with that kind of an estimate, but that seems totally ridiculous to me based off of like the majority of people qualifying for low or no payments. All the interest above that low payment would be subsidized. So I don't know how they possibly could say that this costs $14 billion for interest subsidies. I get a number more like $150 to $200 billion of interest subsidies over 10 years for this new repay plan. You know, there's all this crazy stuff going on. You're seeing all this legal stuff about student loans. This is just a function of where we're at right now. We've got a big advantage in the courts for conservatives, the 6-3 Supreme Court majority. You would expect them to use that to their advantage, right? You've got an advantage with the Democrats in the White House and control of the Senate, so you would expect them to use that to their advantage. And then the House GOP, what are they going to go after? They might care about other things a lot more than student loans, whereas student loans could just be viewed as a distraction for their other policy goals they're trying to achieve. So we're going to have all kinds of just political mess with all this stuff. In terms of who needs to take action, like I said, I think that, you know, if I was somebody that was wondering whether or not I needed to apply for pay-as-you-earn by the deadline, what I would do is get informed. You could obviously book a consult with us, studentloanplanner.com/book. I would highly encourage people who've done a consult with us in the past to do one again. I would probably wait until the rule is finalized, maybe by March or February. And we could see, you know, sort of if there's anybody that's going to challenge it legally, that would probably percolate to the surface by March. And then, you know, we're going to get extremely busy. We're going to have, I would say, wall-to-wall consults probably April, May, and June, preparing for two things. The IDR waiver to expire, which is a big freaking deal, and all these people that are going to have to decide, do I get on pay-as-you-earn or not? So what I would do if I was just trying to maximize the value of the advice and the timing is I'd probably book a call now for like March. If you're in this situation of somebody that's a borrower but that started borrowing between 2007 and 2014 who is not already on pay-as-you-earn, you definitely need to get an analysis to whether or not you need to be on pay-as-you-earn if you're in that situation. A lot of chaos, a lot of confusion, a lot of stress with all this stuff. It's fast moving. You know, they did stuff with this new IDR plan that I just didn't even think that they could possibly do. You know, with shutting off an old plan that the Obama administration created and then making this new plan modified rather than coming out with a new one. If you listen to the Student Loan Planner podcast, you're going to know way more about this stuff, probably too much in some cases than you really even want to know. But I would love it if you would share the Student Loan Planner podcast with your friends. There's all kinds of very valuable things that are going to be happening in 2023 for student loan borrowers, not the least which, too, there's going to be additional more loose qualifications for people signing up for public service loan forgiveness. We think that are coming down the pipeline too. And of course, you're going to have the Supreme Court case that's going to get covered. There could be unintended consequences if the conservative majority strikes down cancellation, where the Biden administration, you know, might seek to do cancellation via some other method or might be tempted to go bigger at the last second with this income-driven repayment plan. I don't think they will, though, because it seems like this plan is really what they were settling on, what they wanted to do. They wanted to make something that was clearly the best plan for 90% of people, and then they wanted to let graduate borrowers have to make a choice between 20-year forgiveness with no interest subsidies and a slightly higher payment and a slightly lower payment with interest subsidies for 25 years, just so that the plan wasn't viewed as a giveaway to doctors and lawyers, right? That's what the House GOP likes to always say. You know, if you think about this plan, they really wanted it to be something that they could market as beneficial to the middle class and the working class and having benefits that were targeted towards a lower income group. Now, what they really did, like a lot of programs, is you have to have political support for these things. And so what they did is they went way into the top 30 percentile of the income distribution with the benefits with this. And that's going to benefit a whole bunch of people in our audience. So I hope you keep listening to the coming week's podcasts. I'm doing the best I can. We're trying to figure out an absolute mess of a childcare situation now that my son's home from the hospital, getting better, trying to get over his lung disease. It's been a real nightmare in terms of all the kids getting sick with everything under the sun. And yours truly has to be the one to stay behind because I love our healthcare workers out there. My wife's a physician, but you know, it's a lot harder to cancel clinic than it is to say, put off your Zoom call, right? So I'm the one that always gets stuck with stuff. If there's a childcare emergency, we're trying to fix that so I can be more present here for you and keep you updated with all these late and breaking headlines with student loans in 2023, because I suspect there will be an absolute massive ton. One more little update for you. The president, according to Politico, is seriously considering ending the COVID emergency from just a policy and political perspective. We will know that by February because they have to give at least, I think it's 2 months notice to the states before they let that expire. That's what they promised. So I would anticipate that you might see them end the COVID emergency. That's also, I think, a strategy to avoid having a lawsuit over it to block their ability to reinstitute an emergency in the future. So we'll see what happens. But when that COVID emergency is over, student loan payments must start. There's no more extending the pause that they lose at the Supreme Court. They have no choice. So we'll keep covering this stuff. If you have any questions about all these plans, I'd love to hear them. studentloanplanner.com/voicemail. And again, if you want to book a plan with our team, studentloanplanner.com/book. We would absolutely love to help you. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Student Loan Planner podcast. Have a wonderful week.